Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 15th, 2009, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking with a common guest, a frequent guest here on Media Matters, the editor of the Progressive magazine, Matt Rothschild, will be joining us for the hour. We'll be talking about politics in America today and in the world, what's going on in Washington and all over the place. And most importantly, we'll be talking about the Progressive magazine, now 100 years old, an extraordinary aspect of American history, and there will be a big celebration of the 100th birthday of the Progressive coming up in about 2 months. We'll be talking about that, so join us today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Public educational and governmental channels, those spots on your cable system best known for covering city council meetings and local events, are one of the last remaining vestiges of local programming in an increasingly consolidated market. But as phone providers like AT&T enter the video business, these local channels are being left behind, seeing their funding cut and their content hidden from viewers. Community television advocates are fighting back. In late January, the Alliance for Community Media joined a nationwide coalition of regional organizations and municipalities in filing a petition at the Federal Communications Commission. Helen Soleil, executive director of the Alliance for Community Media, explained that the filing relates specifically to AT&T discriminating against PEG channels on its U-verse cable television system.
Their U-verse system removes local PEG channels from their standard basic tier lineup and puts them into what they call a Channel 99, which is, of course, way above the basic tier, which is in violation of the law. The way that Channel 99 is handled makes them very difficult for people to navigate it. One of the problems is you still have to go deeper into menus to be able to find the channel.
The PEG channels also can take up to a full 60 seconds to load on the television, can't be recorded by DVR services like TiVo, and show up in a lower resolution, looking like YouTube on your flat screen. Soleil believes that despite the changing media landscape, PEG channels are still relevant and provide a vital platform for community voices.
Local voices will never lose their importance. As technology moves forward, we always seem to continue with the other technologies that we have used before. They may change and morph as PEG is and will, but we don't ever seem to leave them behind. A perfect example is radio. We all still use radio and listen to it.
To learn more about public access, go to rchannels.org.
Whether it's our computer keyboard or a cell phone, we're all holding the means to potentially communicate with millions of people. The implications for politics and government are enormous, says Mika Sifri, the editor of TechPresident.com and curator of the Personal Democracy Forum. He says the changes we are seeing now in communications are as big or bigger than the invention of the printing press.
Until a decade ago, if you wanted to speak in public and reach more than just the people you could shout at with the loudness of your own voice, you couldn't. There were gatekeepers everywhere blocking you. Either it was money or it was somebody with control of the means of communication who would decide whether or not you and your ideas were worth being shared with others.
That's all changed now, but government is still functioning in a print world. Sifri says it's time to move into the 21st century.
It shouldn't be that hard to put legislation online. It's created in a word processing program, after all. Why isn't it posted on the web as fast as it's being sent to the printer? And the answer is just archaic practices. Government has not caught up with what the technology makes possible.
Sifri says that the tools for mapping and data gathering are getting so easy that people are taking government transparency into their own hands through sites like everyblock.com.
Anything that has address data in it can easily be mapped. And so everyblock gives you a kind of very immediate awareness of what's going on around you. Type in your address, and lo and behold, you can see everything from health reports to building permits to crime reports to noise complaints to postings on Craigslist.
Smart government will take advantage of the available technology and the brain trust of the citizenry, Sifri says. For example, Vivek Kundra, the chief technology officer for Washington, D.C., initiated an Apps for Democracy contest that offered $20,000 in cash prizes for outside developers and website designers that made good use of the city's data. Kundra received over 50 well-developed applications.
Had he gone through a normal procurement process to get something like this developed from a government contractor, it probably would have taken years to get the thing built at millions of dollars. And instead, what he did was tap into the creativity of developers, of people who are, in many cases, young, talented software developers who are looking for interesting new projects.
Vivek Kundra is now on President Barack Obama's shortlist of possible nominees for the nation's chief technology officer. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okay. Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 15th, 2009, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. My guest today has been a frequent guest on Media Matters over the past 6 years since we've come on the air, and someone is always a pleasure to have. He is the editor of the Progressive Magazine, based up in Madison, Wisconsin, well-known also as a radio host, as a blogger on the Progressive's website, which is progressive.org. And he's got a new book out that he's edited and here to talk about, among other things, the 100th anniversary of the Progressive Magazine, which is this year, 100 years. That's incredible. Matt Rothschild, welcome to Media Matters.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start right in with the 100th birthday, which is, you know, as I think about it, you know, the Nation magazine has been around now for approaching 150 years. It started right at the end of the Civil War, as I recall. In the Progressive now 100 years, it really, so much has come and gone since then. Why do you think the Progressive has lasted so long? And I'll put this in context as one of the studies independent media for a living. For every magazine like the Progressive, there are 10,000 magazines that were like comets that shone for 5 or 10 years, but they're gone now. But the Progressive's still here, and frankly, as bright as it's ever shined is right now. What accounts for that?
Well, a couple things. One is the tremendous loyalty and generosity of the readers of the Progressive, who've bailed the magazine out time and time again. I've been going through old issues, and in 1948, the editors actually published an issue that said, the last issue, the final issue of the Progressive. And then in the subsequent month, they were inundated with contributions, and that kept them going. The other thing is we've had a wide base of issues and a constancy in those issues. So we haven't changed with the wind at all, and we've had a big enough variety of issues that have remained consistent that people who were interested in peace would read the Progressive. People who were interested in civil liberties would come to the Progressive. People who were outraged about corporate power would rely on the Progressive for their analysis. People who wanted an independent media would come to the Progressive because it was founded as La Follette's Weekly in 1909 as a voice of independent media when the corporation's control of the media was so obvious to the founder, Fighting Bob La Follette. So this is a lot allowed the Progressive to appeal to people across this range, and you know, you can see the arc of the issues come and go. That's one of the nice things about going through these old issues. At the beginning, it was a suffragist magazine.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, Matt, because you've gone through the whole 100 years now. I know you've done a detailed sort of chronology and history of the magazine, preparing for the 100th anniversary celebration in May that's going to take place up in Madison. And I know that you've got a special book out. I've got the galleys right here, The Best of the Progressive Magazine, Democracy in Print is the title of the book. And it might surprise some people to know that the Progressive was started by a Republican. And how have the politics changed, not just the issues, but I mean the political tenor and stance of the magazine, or has it remained fairly consistent? And explain that Republican connection.
Yeah, well, La Falla was a progressive Republican. The progressive movement, really, Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican. And then La Falla in 1924, well, he had a split with Roosevelt, first of all, with Teddy Roosevelt over imperialism, because Teddy Roosevelt was an imperialist. And then La Falla split with Teddy Roosevelt because he didn't think Teddy Roosevelt, for all his rhetoric about going against the trust, was actually going against the trust. And La Falla understood that the mechanisms of the bureaucracy, the FDA, the FCC, things that were put in place to curb corporate power were then captured by those very corporate interests, something that the historian Gabriel Kolko has written about. But there was La Follette talking about it contemporaneously, which was interesting. So La Follette then finally had enough of the Republican Party. And in 1924, he ran as a progressive, as a member of the Progressive Party for president. He got 5 million votes. He did quite well, but it exhausted him. He was more than 70 years old at the time, and he actually died within a year of running for president in 1924.
He actually did pretty well in 1924 and had a lot of influence in American politics, as I recall. I mean, a lot of people who become prominent liberal Democrats in future decades were active in his campaign back then.
Yeah, and the nice thing to realize is that a lot of the things that the progressives championed became law. And in going through these old issues, you know, you can look at child, you know, abolishing child labor, establishing minimum wage, Social Security, unemployment insurance, occupational safety and health, workers' comp, all these things, including suffrage for women and civil rights law. I mean, the Progressive was an anti-lynching magazine in the early part of the 20th century. And so you just see, you see the trend. And then what we've done in the last, well, I've been there 26 years now, we've tried to continue that tradition. And so gay rights fit very well into the tradition of women's rights and civil rights for African Americans. And so that was a natural bit of continuity. The only issue where there's been some going back and forth on, and in going through the old issues, makes me a little queasy, is the issue of out-and-out pacifism when faced with the challenge of Nazism.
And, that was the magazine stance?
It was one of the leading isolationist magazines, actually, in the late 30s and in 1940. And actually, right before, in the issue before Pearl Harbor, it said, I think there was a cover headline that said, "Peace is still possible." So that doesn't look very good in hindsight. And the arguments, I think, have been disproven pretty dramatically. About pacifism and confronting Hitler. I mean, you can appreciate the principled stand of people who are pacifists, and I do, but I don't see how it was possible, looking back, to confront Hitler and preserve freedom without going after him. And to the credit of the editors of the Progressive at the time, they did allow other opinions in there. They allowed the opinion of Upton Sinclair, or Haywood Bruin, who was a progressive columnist at the time, and I think he founded the Newspaper Guild.
He did indeed.
And so he wrote for the Progressive until he died, actually, all through the 30s. And so they had this give and take. And then finally in 1940, the La Follette sons, Robert La Follette, who was a senator, and Phil La Follette, who was a governor of Wisconsin, they kicked out the editor of the time, who was William T. Evue, who was the editor of the Capital Times, who edited the publication for the decade of the 30s, and just said enough of this, because Evue himself saw the need to confront Hitler. And the sons said, no, we gotta stick to the pacifist line.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, joining us today live on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number here, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Matt, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And you can listen to Matt Rothschild's radio daily podcast on WRFU in Urbana, 104.5 FM, every afternoon just after 4 o'clock. And the Progressive's weekly radio show airs every Thursday on WRFU at 4:30. So you've got a following down there in Urbana, Matt.
Well, I appreciate that. And I just want to put a plug in for the interview that's going to be up this week, I believe. It's with the poet Jimmy Santiago Baca, who I just interviewed the other day. And he is a poet, a Chicano poet, who was in prison when he was 18 for drug dealing in Arizona or California. And he was in prison for 6 years. Half of those, he was in solitary confinement. And it wasn't until they put him on death row. He wasn't sentenced to die, but he was a fighter, and the prison guards would come and try to beat him up, and he'd fight back, so finally they put him on death row, that he really had an awakening. He said, if you're in prison, death row is the place to be, because you get better books there. Because the prisoners who are on death row, they don't want to read comic books. They don't want to read trifling things. They want to read the best books they can get a hold of and read them in the time that they have left. So he read the classics, and it just completely changed his outlook, and he became a poet in prison. And so the other prisoners would come up to him and ask him to write poems for their girlfriends or for their daughters or for their moms. And there was a guy, the most brutal prisoner there, who was in for murder and actually had murdered people in the prison, was a member of the Aryan Nation. And he came up to Jimmy Santiago Baca and he said, I need you to write a poem for my mom. And Baca, you know, was scared if he wrote a poem that the guy didn't like, he's going to get killed.
So if he didn't write a poem, he'd get killed. So basically, it's a death sentence.
He looked over his, in his mind, his relationship with his own mom. He found the tender moments. He found some of the more complicated moments. And he wrote a poem in the other guy's voice. And the Aryan Nation guy comes back to the cell and says, where's my poem? And Baca gives him the poem, and he hands it back because he couldn't read. And so Jimmy Santiago Baca reads the poem to the Aryan Nation guy's mom. And while he's reading it, the guy's getting purpler and purpler and grabbing on the irons of the cell. And so Jimmy Santiago Baca thought he was done for. Well, when he was done reading the poem, the guy said to him, how can a little Mexican guy like you know what's in the heart of a white man? And I just thought that was just the most telling anecdote about the power of literature, the power of poetry.
And as an aside, I should say the Progressive magazine, at least as long as you've been editor, I don't know how much further before that it went, has always had poetry as a prominent feature in the magazine.
Yeah, we publish one piece of original poetry every month, and it's something that I started in 1995 with encouragement from Adrian Rich and Martina Spada, two of the greatest poets in America today. And they helped me find poets who are writing very powerful political poems, not didactic poems, poems that have some political message, though, without clubbing you, and that are good poems in and of themselves. And so it's been actually one of the fun things every month, just going through the poems that come in. It's a departure from my usual political rhetoric to look at these poems, to appreciate the art of the poems, and to pick one.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. Matt, the Progressive Magazine, 100th birthday. You're having this big anniversary conference, 100th anniversary conference, up in Madison, Wisconsin, Friday, May 1st, Saturday, May 2nd. And, you know, I'm going through the list, the roster of speakers, people are participating, and I don't know if I've ever seen a conference quite like this in the United States in my memory. I mean, it's a list of some of the people have been writing for you, but a lot of very prominent political figures in the United States, even internationally. Why don't you talk a little bit about what the idea behind the conference was, what you're hoping to accomplish with it, and then explain some of the people you're bringing on board.
Well, the idea was both to have a conference where we discuss the big issues of the day and also to have a celebration, because we don't, in the progressive movement, celebrate enough, and this is time for celebration. I know Jim Hightower's big on that, and I agree with him, and he's going to be there. The conference is called The Progressive Movement Then and Now. We're looking at issues that have been enduring ones throughout our history, taking on the empire or corporate power or civil rights and civil liberties or the environment or the media. And we're trying to get as many people, you know, I've actually been flattered by how many people have agreed to show up. And it's just going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have a lot of panels on Friday. And then on Saturday, we're going to have speakers after speakers. We have elected officials coming, like Senator Russ Feingold, Representative Tammy Baldwin, Representative Dennis Kucinich, Keith Ellison, Jan Schakowsky. But then they're, you know,
let me just interrupt you on that point. Mm-hmm. I've heard all of those members of Congress speak at conferences or one conference or other, and they are all phenomenal speakers. I mean, you don't have one clunker there, and there are many clunkers in Congress you could have brought who politically would be sympathetic. You've managed to avoid all of them.
Well, that may be by luck, but
maybe.
We pick representatives whose politics we like. So, and it's just we're grateful that they know how to speak, which isn't an accident, I don't think. And then we have some of the best writers in the progressive movement are going to be. You're going to be there, Bob. But John Nichols is going to be there. Howard Zinn, Barbara Ehrenreich, Katha Pollitt, Katrina Vandenhoevel. Barbara Ehrenreich is speaking on Saturday night. And Robert Redford, that's the one big Hollywood name we have, which pleases my wife no end, I've got to say. Robert Redford is going to be there on Saturday night. There's Jesse Jackson and Amy Goodman are going to be on Friday night in Madison in an event that's going to be just $10 for anyone who wants to come see Jesse Jackson and Amy Goodman. And that's going to be a thrill. There's one other thing you don't know about, and okay. that is the night before, on April 30th in Madison, there's going to be a concert to celebrate the Progressive. Ani DeFranco, the Indigo Girls, and Dar Williams are all going to be performing at the Orpheum Theater on April 30th in the evening in Madison. So that's going to be a fun event, too.
Matt Rothschild, if people want to learn more about the conference, what the schedule is, how they can participate, how to get a hotel room if they want to come to Madison or go to Madison to be there, what can they do?
The easiest thing is just to go to our website. It's progressive.org. It's not progressive.com that gets you auto insurance. It's progressive.org, and there's information on the conference right there at the top of the homepage.
And our guest, Matt Rothschild, the phone number here at Media Matters, for those who want to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And, you know, we talk about the Progressive magazine, Matt. It's really misleading because you do the radio shows, you do the daily audio commentaries that are aired on a lot of radio stations around the country. You also do a website. You update, you blog on constantly. It's got new material all the time when I click on it. And you blog a lot on current politics. For people unfamiliar with the Progressive or unfamiliar with Matt Rothschild, he's one of the leading commentators on current politics in the United States today. He's at the very top of the list. And I urge you to get in touch with him in his work at progressive.org and at the magazine. But let's talk a little bit about some of your recent writings. First, let's start with the big issue, our economy. You know, what is your sense of the state of our economy and how the politicians have dealt with it so far?
Well, the economy is very fragile, and more fragile, I think, than a lot of us know.
Well, let me ask you, this to interrupt you there, because, I mean, you've been doing the last 100 years. I mean, you know, for the people my age, you're my age, we're both in our 50s now. Welcome to the club. For those of us, you know, when we think of a bad economy, we think of the recessions like of the early 80s or the early mid-70s. There were two very sharp recessions, double-digit, unemployment. Is that what you're looking at here, or do you think we're looking at a qualitatively different animal?
Well, it's different. Those were kind of engineered recessions, especially the one 79 to 81. Paul Volcker, the head of the Fed at the time, insisted on raising interest rates so high that it would throw millions of people out of work, and he did so because he didn't want unions to get more a better deal from their employers to get better wages. And now we have Paul Volcker, who's advising President Obama. I don't know why President Obama picked him for that. The thing that is
maybe
different,
Larry Summers recommended him.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the economic advisors surrounding Obama are a very depressing group, a very corporatist group, and he needs a better economist there like Joseph Stiglitz or James Galbraith or Dean Baker, who predicted the housing crisis. What's different about this than prior recessions is, one, the housing crisis, and number two, the banking crisis. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just a typical recession, and then it's global, too. On the other hand, the hope I have that it's not going to turn into a Great Depression is that, first of all, Obama recognizes we need to have a large stimulus, and other governments around the world, including China and France and other members of the European Union, recognize the need to have counter-cyclical policies here so the recession doesn't go into a depression. The thing that bothered me about Obama's presentation was that he started off by...
You're talking about Monday's news conference now?
Yeah, and just the whole lead-up to it, his whole conception of it was too small. He gave up too much at the beginning. He came in with too small a package. He conceded too much ideologically, like saying we're going to have 90% or more of the jobs in the private sector. He didn't need to do that. It would have been better to have more jobs in the public sector. They're better paying jobs. They're union jobs. They're less likely to throw people out of work. And so he started off too small. I mean, even in the press conference, he acknowledged that his whole mantra of we're going to save or create 3 to 4 million jobs was inadequate. First of all, the verb save gives him a lot of leeway, because if he can just say, well, I saved some people from being thrown out of work, rather than giving the jobs to people who are already out of work, that's a hard thing to quantify. But even if you take him at creating 3 to 4 million jobs. Look, we're bleeding 500,000 jobs a month here.
Yeah.
We're going to lose 6 million jobs this year at that rate. And so what is 3 million or 4 million jobs going to do? We're still going to be down 2 or 3 million jobs.
You know, I mentioned this last week. You mentioned Dean Baker. He was our guest on the program last week. And just before I went on air with that program, I saw a chart from the U.S. House of Representatives that came out of the House on job loss. And it compared this recession, depression, downturn, whatever term you want to use, to the last two at the beginning of the decade and in the early 1990s. And it showed that for the first 12 months, job loss, when it hit its went from its peak, was just about identical the last three times. And then the last two, it bottomed out after 12 months and started slowly edging up. Here, after 12 months, it's like the floor came out, and it's this nosedive three consecutive months. I mean, it was the most striking visual evidence I've seen yet that we're in a very different terrain than we were before.
Yeah, it's a different graph. It's a different time. It's much different severity. Obama, to his credit, though, did say, I mean, at the press conference, the thing I liked about the press conference was it was the most persuasive case I've ever heard from a president, anyway, for a positive intervention in the economy. I mean, you know, there was Bill Clinton saying the era of big government is over. You had Ronald Reagan saying government isn't the solution, it's the problem. I mean, you had to go back to Nixon, really, to find someone who believed in
we are all Keynesians now.
In a Keynesian policy. But when Obama said, you know, the federal government is the only entity left with the resources to jolt our economy back into life, it is only government that can break the vicious cycle, I mean, that is absolutely true. And I found startling echoes of that when I was going through the issues of the Progressive magazine from the 30s. Let me just read a little passage.
Sure,
from
please do.
This is from April 30th, 1938, by Governor Phil LaFollette of Wisconsin, a problem individuals can't solve. And he said, a farmer may be industrious, thrifty, and intelligent, but that farmer's helpless against an economic storm sweeping across the nation. An employer may follow the best methods, may be thrifty, prudent, and far-sighted, and yet he has no alternative but to close his plant when there are no longer orders to fill. Millions of industrious and willing workers lose their jobs through no fault of their own. We can't answer these questions as lone individuals. They can be solved only by acting together as an organized people. That was Governor Phil LaFollette in 1938 saying quite the same thing that Barack Obama was saying here in 2009.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Our phone number here, if you'd like to call in with question or comment, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Matt, you know, when you look at these debates over the economy, one thing that is I'm struggling with and I'm trying to make sense of is the Republican Party's position. And I don't mean this facetiously. I mean, and you're smiling as I say this because I really don't. I've understood the Republican Party's economics. I haven't agreed with them, but I've sort of understood their basis at one point in time. Now I get the feeling I don't understand them any longer. Can you explain, how do you see the Republican Party's response to this crisis?
Well, it's economic idiocy, for one thing. I mean, let's just call it what it is. It's just a complete economic illiteracy. Every economist with any decent reputation from the right to the left, including Mark Zandi, who was John McCain's economist, understands we need a big stimulus package here. So they are being Hooverites. They want us to go back to the policies that got us into the Great Depression. But I think basically they're following Rush Limbaugh, who said they want Obama to fail. And any sand they can throw into the gears, they think is successful. I don't think that's going to be a winning gambit for them, but this is really know-nothingism. And basically Obama should just take it to them and say, you know, go to districts where senators and representatives on the Republican side are vulnerable and say, your elected official here wants you to be out of a job.
You know, one of the issues that's been sort of a subtext in everything we've been talking about on the deliberations and debates over the stimulus package has been Obama's commitment to bipartisanship, and that this is sort of, you know, almost like the mandate he received from the American people above all else was to find the Republican position, take the position of the people who voted for him, and split the difference. And that would be where the people who voted for him don't want their politics. They want politics halfway to the Republican side. And that this is what the country was missing for the last 8 years, was this sort of split the difference bipartisanship. Where does bipartisanship stand now, and how realistic was that as an approach in the first place?
Well, it was terribly naive, and I don't know why he construed his mandate that way, because a vast plurality, anyway, of the American people wanted nothing to do with the last 8 years of policies, foreign or domestic, that the Bush administration and the Republicans had put forward. So Obama was here at his position and moment of maximum strength and really could have pushed much harder in a progressive direction. Rather, you know, he goes and sups with George Will and Charles Krauthammer and Bill Kristol. I hope the Secret Service tested the food first, because I wanted to want to be in that company, unguarded anyway. And, you know, after that, he brought people over to the White House for the Super Bowl. He thought that would convince him. He put Republican legislators on Air Force One. He thought that would bring him around. And guess what? It didn't. So he was naive. I mean, I think part of it was he thought first of all, he's logical, so he believes in logic. So he thought the power of logic might persuade these people. And secondly, I think he thinks he's got a great power of persuasion and thought his own power of persuasion would bring people around. But it didn't. This is politics. This is hardball. And Republicans are playing hardball. And I think if he decides, Obama, to stop playing this bipartisan card and start really calling Republicans out on the carpet, I think he's going to do better, because he's going to put so much pressure at the grassroots that they're going to have to come around. They're not going to come around because he's being nice to them.
Yeah, my sense when during the presidential campaign, Matt Rothschild, was that, you know, someone was obsessed with finding someone who could work across the aisle. They thought that was the single great issue in American life, was getting someone who can get Republicans and Democrats working together. John McCain made a fairly compelling case. He had a better record of that in Congress than Barack Obama had. I mean, he said that if that's your issue, I'm your guy, and he got clobbered. So I don't exactly see where that was a mandate for that sort of bipartisanship.
No, it wasn't a mandate for that. It was a mandate for change. And then so to split the difference on change, as you were suggesting earlier, isn't what he was elected to do. And so I think maybe he's coming around on this. The other reason he's been putting it forward is it polls well. I mean, you know, saying, you know, I want to put my hand out across the aisle. Yeah. And, you know, people say, well, let's put our differences aside. But look, this is an ideological battle. Does government have a role to protect people's jobs or not? Or are we going to be just thrown at the cruel and not so tender mercies of the corporate sector?
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. The phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Matt, I just want to follow up on this issue about the Republicans for your thoughts. And this is a semi-rhetorical question, but it's something I think about. You know, we have a two-party system in the United States, and the electoral laws are written in such a way as to make it extraordinarily difficult to replace one of the two parties or to create a viable third party. I mean, it takes like a civil war almost, you know, the collapse of the country to get us to that point. I don't think we're anywhere near that point at now. What does it do to our political culture if one party, like the Republicans, is, you know, they're taking these really almost creationist views of the economy, and they have sort of given justice to half the political debate gets taken by people who are talking about this stuff. I mean, it sort of drags the whole debate over to places that are really unproductive, doesn't it?
It does, and I think it sows confusion. I think that's their goal. That's the whole goal of Rush Limbaugh. That's the whole goal of John Boehner, to sow confusion in the American mind about what Obama's program is going to do, what's needed for the economy, what the New Deal was all about. I mean, one of the funny things in Obama's press conference was when he acknowledged that, you know, these people are refighting the New Deal here. And he thought this was a settled issue a long time ago.
Where's he been?
But there it is. I mean, you can go through, as I have over the last week, through magazines of the 1930s, like The Progressive at the time, and see the same debates. You know, are we going to have government programs or not? Are we going to cut the budget? Is cutting the budget the answer to everything? Those things are unresolved yet. And it's about power. It's not just that they're economically illiterate, the Republicans. It's they want corporations to have the power in this country, not the people to have the power.
Matt Rothschild, have you been surprised in any way by President Obama's administration since he's assumed office? Or has this pretty much been what you expected, before January 20th?
You know, it's kind of what I expected. He's doing some good things on some domestic issues. This Lilly Ledbetter law to make it easier for women to sue for sexual discrimination in the workplace was a good thing. Lifting the gag rule on funding for abortions overseas was a good thing. And yet you look at economic policy and it's a very timid kind of corporatist, if a little bit Keynesian, policy. And in foreign policy, he talks a talk, but in some ways he's not walking the walk. I'm talking about the equivocation about torture. Mm-hmm. The equivocation about torture in a ticking time bomb situation, this secrecy about renditions that the Obama administration went into court, both in England and in the United States, to say it was going to keep documents that some of the people who were detained wanted released and keep those secrets. Actually, the Bush administration had threatened the government of Britain that if it released documents on the detention of one of these guys, that the United States was going to stop cooperating with Britain on intelligence matters.
This is recently.
Yeah, this was the Bush administration. And then so the Obama administration comes in and the British court asks the Obama administration if their policy has changed. No, it's the same policy. Mm. So Obama is, in that regard, carrying on ridiculous and immoral policies of the Bush administration.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive. Go to progressive.org to learn all about the magazine, see their updated blogs. Learn about also the 100th anniversary celebration of the Progressives will be taking place in Madison, Wisconsin, Friday, May 1st and Saturday, May 2nd, 2009, just about 10 weeks away approximately, with absolutely a galaxy of stars unlike any event I've ever seen. If you're interested in progressive politics in the United States, this is really the can't-miss event. Our phone numbers here at Media Matters to talk to Matt Rothschild, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to a patient caller. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Matt Rothschild.
Hi, yeah. Renews my optimism, or my... I voted for Green Party. I voted for Cynthia McKinney, and I'm very glad I did. He didn't need me in Illinois, so I'm afraid I'm not terribly surprised, except for the extent of this. This business about the North Carolina, the Boeing continuing state secrecy is also about extraordinary rendition. I guess we're just going to have ordinary kidnapping in the future. But I guess I'll stay with the economics point of view, and I wonder whether, you know, you've been talking stimulus, you haven't really talked bank bailout, and the fact that, you know, in England, the bankers that were apologizing right and left this week were sacked. They were no longer, the ones that sort of made lame apologies in our Congress were still had their jobs. So I just, I'm not terribly hopeful. And a broader point I wanted to make is about the bipartisan business. I think it does poll well, and I think that I'm thinking it isn't naivete. I'm thinking it's he wants to do something to entitlements. Lawrence Summers has said entitlements have to be dealt with. Dean Baker, who was on last week and who you cited, has co-written the book about the phony crisis of Social Security. I don't think they're going to try and privatize anything, but they're going to take an axe to Social Security, I'm afraid, and he needs, you know, I don't know what he needs Republicans to participate in that, and I'm actually very worried about that, and I hope in your capacity you rise to that occasion and do a little preemptive work on maybe a short article by Dean Baker on, if you haven't done that already, so I'm not following it. So I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thanks.
And Matt, before you respond, because I know you're itching to respond, I should point out, and you wrote a nice piece called Nationalize the Banks on the progressive.org website just this week. So this is an issue you've thought long and hard about.
And also the caller's other point, too, about Social Security and the privatization of that. I did weigh in on that by bringing to light the fact that Peter Orszag, Obama's appointment to head the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, that this guy 2 years ago or 3 years ago authored a paper that said we have to cut back on Social Security benefits. And the amazing thing is, of course, Obama during the election campaign was saying, look, John McCain wants to cut your Social Security benefits. And as soon as Obama gets in, he puts someone in, head of the Office of Management and Budget, who is on record as saying he wants to cut Social Security.
You know, it's funny,
benefits.
James Galbraith, who was on our program a few weeks ago, too, talking about this, said one of the things they should do immediately in the stimulus is dramatically raise Social Security immediately, since so many seniors have seen their savings collapse. And this money would all get spent. It would be, you know, it would be socially just, and it would also be smart economics.
Yeah, it's like giving more benefit to people who are unemployed or more food stamps. All that money's going to go straight in. Seniors have seen whatever investments they had, if they had any investments, the return on those investments go down to zero, and the value of their homes evaporate.
Plummet, yeah.
And so yeah, it makes sense to raise Social Security, but I do think that Obama is going to cut Social Security or try to cut it. And again, that's not what he was elected to do.
Well, talk about the banks for a second, too, because, to me, I think the caller made a really good point, and you talk about it in your piece. I mean, stimulus aside, the whole stimulus package was premised on the idea that the banking system would be up and running and functional again. Otherwise, the stimulus loses much of its effect or possible effect. And the options seem to be, as I understand it, the approach of many European countries, which is more or less to nationalize them, take them over and get rid of the people who've run them into the ground, and basically to make the shareholders take the losses that capitalists, in capitalism, theoretically, shareholders are supposed to take when their companies screw up. It seems to me, and I'm not an expert at this, but as I look at the Obama plan that Geithner's put together and Summers and these guys, it's basically obsessed with keeping shareholders' investments sound, first and foremost.
Yeah, it's quite amazing because actually Geithner had a comment where he said, "We have a financial system that is run by private shareholders, managed by private institutions, and we'd like to do our best to preserve that system." Well, that isn't the job of the Obama administration. It shouldn't be the job even of the Treasury Secretary. The job should be getting the economy working for the American people. And this question of nationalization, I mean, to me, it boils down to let's get rid of the middleman. I mean, we've been giving hundreds of billions of dollars to these banks on the hope that they would lend to companies and lend to people who want to buy homes. They haven't been doing that. They've been hoarding the cash or buying other banks or going on junkets or giving their executives big pay. Well, let's just get rid of them and lend directly. And furthermore, they don't deserve the money. They are the ones who caused the whole U.S. economy and the world economy, for that matter, to crash. Why reward them and reward them and reward them?
Yeah, I agree. It just seems completely illogical to me that we're spending vastly greater sums than we'd have to spend otherwise. Economically, it's indefensible. But I think the point that a lot of economists have made is that were these banks ought to go to Warren Buffett and say, "We want you to bail us out," he would put strong terms on it. Those are the sort of terms those taxpayers have a right to get. If they're going to put up, you know, $1 trillion or $2 or $3 trillion to bail out these shareholders, they should get something in return besides just promises down the road after they get their, you know, bonus trips paid for. They might get something out of it.
And we're getting nothing. We're getting no control. We're netting, you know, maybe some trimming of executive compensation, but no demands on lending to businesses and to putting a halt to foreclosures. And the just from an economic standpoint, I mean, we are overpaying these banks for what they're worth, and we're still not taking them over. That is the $20 billion, the last $20 billion installment that the U.S. government gave Citibank. We could have used that same $20 billion to buy Citibank outright, fire the executives, get rid of some of their worst loans that they've made, and make Citibank start to give loans to companies and to give people that they gave bad mortgages to, you know, a break on paying their mortgages.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I'm going to go back to the phone lines in a second, so if you're there, please wait patiently. I promise I'll get to you. If you'd like to join us, the number 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. But, Matt, before we get back to the phone lines, I do want to ask you about a column that Glenn Greenwald wrote in Salon.com this week. I don't know if you saw it. It was an exception. I thought a really interesting column on our political moment. It really pertains to the question that you just received over the air, which is that Greenwald said that one of the reasons why we're seeing Obama basically backslide on the bank issue and backslide on entitlements, basically Medicare and especially Social Security, it looks like he's definitely queuing up to do the sort of right wing of the Democratic Party move to trim these against the will of the vast majority of people who voted for him, is that these sort of liberal organizing groups and institutions, and I think he meant, for example, MoveOn.org, even some of the websites like Daily Coast to some extent, but especially Move On, they aren't kicking his butt. They're so concerned with protecting his butt from Republicans' attacks, they aren't doing what the right wing does, which is to force these candidates they get elected to do what they said they were going to do in the first place. I mean, do you think that these sort of so-called liberal grassroots organizations are really laying down on the job?
Definitely, and you know, it's time for a divorce. I mean, you know, you need to support Obama when he's supporting progressive principles and depart from and criticize Obama when he's not. Edward Said has the famous line, never solidarity before criticism. And it's a line that I take to heart here. But look, compare this situation to what was happening in the 1930s. In the 1930s, there was a real social base for putting pressure on Roosevelt from the left, the progressive movement, the progressive magazine, the labor movement, the unemployed millions of people were putting a lot of pressure on FDR to move to the left. And right now, where is the social movement pressure coming to tell Obama to move to the left? There's all the centrifugal force of being in Washington, listening to the pundits, listening to the centrist organizations, and listening to his corporatist officials in the Treasury Department to, you know, move to the center or move to the right. And we need to up the volume here and take it, advantage of the communication channels that Obama seems to be opening up for people to, you know, comment or whatever and say, you know, we didn't elect you to give us a 9% cut in Social Security, because that's what Peter Orszag, his OMB guy, says we all should get if you're under 35.
You know, it's not just Social Security and possibly Medicare that seem to be likely candidates for attack under the Obama administration, barring some change. But it's also now there's question, is this how committed Obama is to his campaign commitment to the Employee Free Choice Act and making it possible for workers to establish unions as easy as it is now for workers to dissolve them? Now, if you get a majority of workers who want to get rid of their union, all they have to do is sign up and it's automatically abolished. But to start a union, you've got to run through this gauntlet that makes it virtually impossible in the private sector. And he made a strong commitment to supporting the Employee Free Choice Act in his campaign, got massive labor support. I don't think there's any question that the difference in between labor and non-labor votes among working class people is astonishing for Democrats. And now, though, it looks like, you know, there's concern, I think, that, you know, he's going to be backing down because there's such spectacular business pressure not to have labor unions.
Yeah, well, this is what I mean. The pressure from the right, the pressure from the corporate sector, the pressure from the punditocracy is something that he feels more than he feels the pressure from those of us in the progressive movement or even the labor movement. But he, you know, the labor movement went to bat for him. And so we'll have to see, you know, is he going to go to bat for Hilda Solis, his yeah. labor secretary this coming week, or is he going to make her walk the plank? I got to hope that he's going to defend her. And she's a big supporter of the Employee Free Choice Act. And I'm hoping, maybe I'm naive here, that he's going to back that. But, you know, what we're really looking at is kind of, you know, Bill Clinton without the libido here as far as Obama's politics.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines. And line one, Champagne, thank you very much for your patience. You're on the air.
Yeah, I agree with you. I've been very disappointed since the election that Mr. Obama is looking just an awful lot too much like Bill Clinton for my taste, which is, you know, he's Reagan-light, basically, in many ways. But in his defense, and what I'd like you to comment upon, I had the impression or the idea that when he won the election, that whoever won the election, if they were of a liberal frame of mind, they won it too soon because things, I don't think, have really gotten become bad enough in the country to get the Vox Populi excited enough that they would view someone who openly referred to himself as a Reagan Republican with something less than, in a situation, something lesser than being a pedophile, you know, that you're a Republican? Well, what kind of nut are you? And that kind of thing. The poor man, I think, has basically become the captain of the Titanic after it hit the iceberg, and things just aren't really bad enough yet to really create the shift that's required in the nation to change its thinking. I would like you to comment on that, please. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Matt Rothschild?
Well, I do think we've hit the iceberg, so I think the caller's right on that. It's bad enough for a lot of people. The question is what happens politically to those people, and do they react in a way that is resignation, or do they react in a way that is right-wing populist and blame everything on immigrants, for instance, which a lot of the Republicans would want them to do?
I got to say, because I mean, this gets back, Matt, to the question I asked you earlier about the Republican Party and their you know, what they have to offer to respond to the economic crisis. I mean, even is there any reason to think the American people, frankly, are so stupid that if they try to say ignore this depression, ignore the collapse of the economy, ignore that there's no investment, the decline in standard of living, collapse of public services, it's all due to immigration, and is that at all a ticket that could win in this country?
I would hope not, but I just don't know. I mean, the question is the Pat Buchanan, Sarah Palin wing of the Republican Party going to win out? And appears to be winning out right now and with Rush Limbaugh. That seems to be the center of gravity there, not the Olympia Snow, Arlen Specter wing of the Republican Party. And so if they're going to go that far out, you know, they're going to gin up the propaganda against all sorts of people. And then they're going to blame Obama because he hasn't solved the economy. The reason he won't have solved the economy is they, you know, kept biting into his stimulus package. And that's what they're hoping for. I don't think, you know, I'm hoping that's not going to work. And Obama has a great ability to communicate directly to people. So he needs to do what he's been doing the last few days, which keep going out and talking to people and getting out of Washington. But there is ugliness out there, and they're really playing with fire, these right-wing Republicans, if they are going to just kind of feed this ugliness.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, which is now in its 100th year, founded by Fighting Bob La Falla, the legendary U.S. senator and Wisconsin governor who was really a champion of the progressive movement. And a lot of the progressive reforms of this country's history really can be traced to Bob La Falla and the progressive movement. I don't know how much people really in our history courses today we oftentimes associate with the New Deal, for example. A lot of the stuff you mentioned earlier in the program, which really come out of the progressive era.
Yeah, I mean, you know, child labor was legal here until the early part of the 20th century, and it was something that the Progressive Magazine and La Falla championed forever. Women getting the vote happened in the early part of the 20th century because of that as well. And a lot of these other reforms, unemployment insurance, Social Security, safety on the job, workers' comp, all these things. And then, of course, on the Democratic, formal Democratic, you know, direct election of senators, that didn't happen until the progressives demanded it. And so the record of success is really dramatic. And there was a lovely piece in the Progressive way back in the 1920s by La Falla himself, who said that the demands by the progressives and the demands by the socialists, the Socialist Party, one after another, have been integrated into the main parties of this country and become law.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. Matt, we had someone who emailed in a question or called it in, but gave it to our producer, Andrew Boyle, to pass along to me, who apparently is quite critical of Obama, and sort of wonder why the American citizenry put up with a crook from Chicago politics and let him become president, and is there some way that Obama can be impeached?
Well, I don't think there's evidence that Obama is a crook. I mean, he came out of Chicago, and there are a lot of crooks in Chicago, but that's guilt by association. And I don't think there's grounds for impeaching Barack Obama. I mean, there's certainly grounds for impeaching, lots of grounds for impeaching Bush and Cheney. But Obama is, you know, he's been in office, what, you know, a month, and, you know, I don't see any high crimes and misdemeanors that have come out of him. My view of Obama is that he's an incredibly talented, intelligent, able politician, very gifted politician, who actually comes out of the progressive movement, that he understands progressive politics in a way that our other presidents really haven't. And yet he's being pulled and tugged in the wrong directions. And maybe his ambition is pulling him that way, too. And it's all the more important for people at the grassroots to demand of the Democratic Party, to demand of the people who ran Obama's campaign, and to go to whitehouse.gov. And if there's any open channel there, to send your demands in there, too, that we don't want Obama moving to the right. We want Obama to stand up for workers' rights. We want Obama to preserve and expand Social Security and Medicare, not cut it back. And across the board, we need to let our voices be heard. Otherwise, he is going to drift in the wrong direction. But I don't think he's a crook.
Matt Rothschild, you know, you've mentioned once or twice already in the program the importance of how the punditocracy, sort of the talking heads of Washington, especially on cable TV news, but also at the editorial pages of the major newspapers, create sort of a pressure on what their legitimate range of debate is. And in your view, from what I gather, this is really a negative force in American politics.
It's a negative force, and I think there's a psychological pressure on an elected official like Obama who wants to succeed, and most politicians want to please, too, and to see himself criticized, day in and day out for, spending too much money and running the deficit too high. I mean, those are illogical criticisms from an economic recovery standpoint, but to be hammered with them time and time again is something that, he's going to hear and then wonder, and then he's going to get this barrage about, oh, there's this crisis in Social Security, the system's going bankrupt, which is a bunch of junk. And yet if he believes it, or if he's tugged by it, then, we've gone off in a different direction. That's why we'd have a much healthier democracy if we had a healthier, wider range of media voices that reached him, and not only him, but the power elite in this country, and reached the people at the grassroots.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. We've only got a few minutes left, Matt. I'd like to return, if we could, to the conference that the Progressive Magazine will be holding May 1st and May 2nd in Madison, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Progressive Magazine since its founding in 1909 by Bob La Follette. And again, I mean, I'm going through the program here for it. It's an astonishing group of people you've got together. Why don't you, in the time we have left, in a couple of minutes, maybe go through two or three of the sessions to draw some sense of what people will be experiencing if they're able to attend this.
Well, it's kind of like a nation cruise for people who get seasick and can't afford it.
Yeah, can't afford it.
But we're going to have a session, for instance, on combating corporate power. And Jim Hightower is going to be there. Joan Claybrook from Public Citizen is going to be there. Jane Slaughter of Labor Notes. And I believe Roseanne DeMauro of the California Nurses Association may be there as well. And so that's going to be a great panel. There's a panel on extending democracy, which is going to show, how we can go further to make our democracy stronger in some formal way. And then there's defending civil rights for all. We've got Salim Wakil of In These Times there.
He's terrific.
He's great. And Luis Rodriguez, a poet and author and an activist. And Rhea Carey, who's the executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. She's terrific. On the peace movement, there's Cindy Sheehan and Bonnie Erfer of Nuke Watch and Frieda Berrigan of the New American Foundation, who's the daughter of Phil Berrigan. So that's going to be a great panel, too. That's just a taste.
Although he was a priest.
He was, but
he was. Is the operative word there? Okay. Actually, we have time for one more call, so let's go to the lines for our final caller. Line 4, Bloomington, you're on the air with Matt Rothschild.
Yeah, thank you. I love your magazine.
Thank you.
Whatever, in Obama got him this far, he's going to use it, and you're talking about shifting to the right more. Is he going to use it to stay in power, or is he going to use it for the people? That's my thought all along.
Well, I would hope that he, unlike almost any other politician, would say, I really don't care if I get reelected. I've got a shot here at really improving people's lives and setting this country on a progressive course, and I'm going to do what is right and let the chips fall where they may. And if I succeed and people want me, great. If they don't, that's okay, too. I can go write books, which he's very good at.
One of the things that strikes me is this seems the comparison to the 30s is apt because this isn't like when Bill Clinton came to power in 1993 or Jimmy Carter in 1977. If just following the conventional wisdom of the party and doing the usual stuff isn't going to solve these problems, they aren't going to go away. Eventually, he's going to face the recognition that it's going to take really dramatic reform. And that moment might be coming sooner than we all realize. It could be this summer or this fall. And that will really be, I guess, to some extent, the measure of whether what he's made of.
And his moderate impulses may be fatal. I mean, that's the real problem.
That's right.
Fatal for this country and for his political future.
Matt Rothschild, we've only got about 30 seconds or so left. Any closing comments you'd like to make?
Well, I just want to invite everyone to Madison on April 30th, May 1st, and May 2nd. April 30th with a concert with Ani DeFranco and the Indigo Girls and Dar Williams. And then we have this big panel and great show coming up on May 1st and May 2nd here in Madison. So thanks for having me, Bob.
My pleasure, Matt Rothschild. Go to the website progressive.org to learn about that, to find out about the magazine. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WIL AM580. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board. Andrew Boyle, my producer, will be back 1 week from today with Matt Taibbi talking about the state of journalism and in politics in America today. Until then, have a great week, everyone. See you in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today should be mostly cloudy with highs reaching 33 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy skies with a low around 20. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high reaching 38. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low of 27. And Tuesday, partly cloudy with a high of 42. This is WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2.